I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In just a moment, software that predicts the future, a machine that translates all human language, what the world's top engineers see ahead. But first, we're learning more about U.S. airstrikes in Somalia, the first overt military action in that country since the failed Black Hawk Down mission of the early 90s. U.S. helicopter gunships launched new attacks today near the site of yesterday's airstrikes, both reportedly targeting Islamic militants who allegedly planned and executed the deadly U.S. embassy bombings in Kenya and Tanzania in 1998. The White House has not confirmed the attacks. Joining us from bordering Kenya is Christian Science Monitor reporter Mike Flans, who recently returned from Somalia. And Mike, can you start by telling us about these latest attacks? What are you hearing? Do you know about casualties or fatalities?
Yes, there are sketchy reports coming out of these areas in southern Somalia where the Americans launched the attacks yesterday and late on Monday. There is some suggestion that up to 20 civilians have been injured or killed. There are no numbers on the amount of the Islamists who have been killed. These were the guys that the Americans went in to target in the first place. Still very difficult to get any details from Somalia.
Well, give us some context. We know that Ethiopian troops recently invaded Somalia to support the weak but recognized government and rout these Islamic militants who'd taken over. And they'd been seen, you know, trying to flee the country, throwing away their guns. Is that why the U.S., you know, positions these attacks now?
Yes, I think that's right. I was speaking to somebody in Nairobi today who was telling me that this is perfect timing for the U.S. to have attacked both Washington and the government in the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa, are convinced that the Islamists, who had held control over most of Somalia, were also looking after, sheltering, or hosting the Al-Qaeda-linked agents who carried out bombing attacks in Kenya and Tanzania in 1998. So Ethiopia sent its troops in as of about December the 24th to begin an offensive against the Islamists in Somalia. The U.S. has come in on Monday night and yesterday with what we can call mopping up operations with the remnants of the Islamists who were grouped in a small area of southern Somalia.
One of the targets, Fazul Abdullah Mohammed, he's alleged to have planned the U.S. embassy attacks that resulted, to remind ourselves, in more than 200 dead in Kenya and Tanzania. Is there any sense of how he fared through the attacks?
This is a key point, isn't it? If Washington had launched this kind of attack on Somalia, the main thing that they've been looking to do is to get rid of the guys they initially said were in there. Fazul Mohammed, as you say, was said to be linked to the bombings of the U.S. embassies in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam. There are two or three other names which have been cropping up who the U.S. and Addis Ababa claim were in Mogadishu. A gentleman called Al-Sudani, he's said by Washington to be Al-Qaeda's point man in Somalia. No details yet, Robin, as to which of those have been or have not been killed in this attack. There are no confirmations of the identities of the people who were targeted by the Americans on Monday night and yesterday's.
Well, wire reports are saying that the president and deputy prime minister of Somalia supported the alleged strikes. Will average Somalis feel the same way?
It's difficult to say. The support that the average Somali gave to the Islamic Courts Union, this is the umbrella body which had controlled Somalia until the Ethiopians came in some 2 weeks ago. And they were very popular. They brought in a level of security and stability which hadn't been seen in the country for some time. But then there were radical elements within that umbrella organization, which the U.S. was very suspicious of, which Addis Ababa was very suspicious of. Now, those are the people who the Americans were targeting, we believe, in the attacks yesterday. The ordinary Somali will not want those people in the country. That's for sure, because all it does is bring the focus of the international war on terror on Somalia. Let's not forget this is a country which has had no national government for 15 years. The ordinary Somalis, as we're talking of, their country is completely shattered. The one thing they want above all else is peace. The quickest way to do that is to remove that focus of international attention. And Washington obviously believes that the quickest way to do that is to target these supposed Al-Qaeda agents who were in Mogadishu and now in southern Somalia.
Mike Flans, Stringer for the Christian Science Monitor, speaking to us from Nairobi in neighboring Kenya about today's U.S. airstrikes in Somalia targeting alleged Al-Qaeda operatives. Mike, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
And this quick news note, American fighter jets streaked over central Baghdad today as U.S. and Iraqi soldiers battled suspected Sunni insurgents for several hours. Iraqi officials said 50 militants were killed. The fierce fighting began when gunmen attacked Iraqi army checkpoints. Iraqi soldiers then called on the U.S. military for help. The battle comes less than 48 hours before President Bush delivers a speech to the nation on Iraq's strategy, in which he's expected to call for an additional 20,000 U.S. troops in Iraq. Of course, we'll have full coverage on that tomorrow. Electric cars that you plug into your electric socket in your garage, a 108-inch LCD TV screen, a personal taser, and the iPhone. These are just a few of the new technologies unveiled this week at the Detroit Auto Show and the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. But what's next? Well, to answer that question and more, we turn to Susan Hassler. She's the editor of IEEE Spectrum Magazine. They conducted a survey of 700 members of the Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers. They're called Fellows, and they are the elite, the movers and shakers in technology. Writer Ray Kurzweil, for instance. And they were asked to identify key breakthroughs and forecast trends in their areas of expertise. We want to spend a few minutes today with Susan to hear some of the results. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Robin.
And I know this is everyone's favorite topic because it's been around so long. Robots, you know, we see them, they clean people's floors, you know, they vacuum. But what did your people say? Are they going to do more sophisticated things in the near future?
Well, what we found in this survey was that the fellows were quite down to earth in their assessment of things. We like to think that they separated the real stuff from the cool stuff. So although we'd like to have a kind of Fred Flintstone robot that will follow us around the house and do everything we need to have done, they really didn't feel that that's going to happen anytime soon. Right. And they didn't feel that elder care robots would really become a reality anytime soon.
Which is something people have talked about, but you say no.
People have talked about this for particularly in places like Japan, where they've made a lot of effort to try to make robots that could perhaps take the place of caregivers. But these fellows were not seeing this happening any time in the next 20 or 30 years. Mm. They did think, though, that we will see a lot more kind of household applications of robots. The one that's on television now is the Roomba home vacuuming system, a somewhat successful robotic device that will vacuum your floors for you. But something that actually approaches the cognitive ability of people is probably not happening anytime soon.
So to the computer front, machines get faster, more powerful every year. But apparently your people said that we're not going to see the long-awaited, super-fast, atomic-powered commercial quantum computer, not even in the next 50 years?
Quantum computers get a lot of attention in the science magazines. Even in my own magazine, we've speculated a lot about quantum computers, and they're actually extremely difficult to create and then extremely difficult to think about how you would actually use them. So where they really see computing taking a very big leap forward is that there'll be lots and lots of computing power, which will make many things possible in terms of what you can do with it.
Such as? What are some of the things?
Well, I think that with all of this stuff, with this combined with something that are these sensors that people are talking about, there will be this possibility of doing a lot of very sophisticated deep data mining. It's like if you're the Internal Revenue Service, it's one thing to collect a lot of information about people, and it's another thing to actually be able to analyze it. And fortunately, right now, the Internal Revenue Service has relatively little capability to analyze the data that they collect. But going forward, it might be possible for them to look at your tax records over 15 years and actually look for little anomalies. And so you can imagine extending that to all sorts of other situations.
Well, one interesting thing that we're reading about computers is this idea of simulation literacy. That's where you have these interactive computer graphics and you can create these virtual worlds and program them to find out, you know, how you'd look if you went on a certain diet or if you ran 10 miles every day. When might this become real?
There are a number of groups that are working on exactly the kind of simulation you describe, where you could feed in some of your behaviors, maybe 200 or 300 of them, and then maybe you'd be able to run some different scenarios. The famous example that this group in Amsterdam is working on is, you know, what would happen if you went on vacation with person X as opposed to person Y? Huh. How might that turn out? or what would happen, as you describe, if you decided to really take up a serious in the exercise and diet regimen.
But so much, for instance, of those two things you mentioned, diet or being able to run 10 miles a day, it depends on things like will, you know, which mm-hmm. you don't even know you have until you're in the seventh mile. So mm-hmm. that's so interesting, because how would you, what would you put into software? What data would you put in to find out how you do?
I think you would put in things about what your personal behavior already is right now. So you would. So it would be based on your current situation, what your future situation might be. Some of it you can actually do now in a very primitive way with some of the stuff. If you bought a Nike shoe with an electronic monitor on it that will tell you things about what you're doing in terms of your, just right now in terms of your exercise routine. But just imagine blowing that out so that you could really think about it in terms of your personal life.
Huh. Well, this is, it's fascinating. Another question on the survey, which seemed like everyone agreed on, was whether we'd be seeing in the next 10 years the proliferation of so-called RFID-enabled devices. The RFID meaning radio frequency identification. These are those tiny sensors that get implanted into objects or, in some cases, people. And most of your people agreed that we're going to see these or more of these.
Well, I think we'll see them everywhere. I mean, the reason I think people think we'll see them is they're getting cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. And so what it means, these little tags, it means that it's sort of like being a buoy out in the water and you're sending out a signal. It says, I'm here, I'm here. Walmart, for example, is putting RFID tags on all of their pallets for their inventory because it allows them to track the inventory that goes through their massive operation. In some instances, you can put an RFID tag on, say, a Gillette razor blade, so you could follow it from the store into someone's house, into someone's bathroom.
But that's one thing. But we understand, for instance, in Japan, school kids are having them implanted in their clothes.
Right. The reason they're wearing them in their clothes, Robin, is so that parents can find out when their children arrive at school. And so the way it works is when the kids are coming into school, they're passing through these detectors, through these RFID readers that then send an email to the parents to say, your son is here now, your daughter is here now. Hmm. In Barcelona, there's a club in Spain where the VIP people who come to the club have, in fact, had these chips implanted in their arms so that instead of having to, fork over their platinum credit cards, they simply can wave their arm over one of these readers to order another round.
Oh, my. Well, of course, the downside of that is that you're wandering through another bar and you don't mean to buy a drink and you wander by the reader and, whoopsie, you've bought one. That's fascinating and a little weird. But to many people, it does sound like Big Brother, you know. Are your scientists concerned about the personal privacy issues that are raised with many of these things? I mean, what are they saying about that?
I think the smartest people who work in science and technology are always concerned about what the consequences, intended or otherwise, could be. And certainly, you can imagine what the privacy issues would be here. Because if it's possible for basically everything around you to kind of be paying attention to what you're doing and what you're buying and where you're going, it is possible for someone to watch that behavior. So you can imagine how this could quickly become overwhelming, and then you could imagine how people could use this to ill effect.
Susan Hassler is editor of IEEE Spectrum magazine. They surveyed engineers and technologists about the future. So, will nanobots stream through our bloodstreams? Will there be life on other planets? We'll have much more from Susan after the break about what those guys thought, and women as well. And remember, later today, those who wield a nail gun also write poetry, carpenter poetry. That's still coming up. More ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Still to come today, a mother who lost her son on 9/11 and pushed to create the 9/11 Commission. On today's move by Congress to enact some of the Commission's recommendations, that's still coming up. But first, we're back with Susan Hassler, editor of IEEE Spectrum magazine, which surveyed movers and shakers to look at the future of technology. And we've been talking about supercomputer power and smart barcodes and radio frequency implants. But Susan, what about the closer to home? For instance, we've been hearing about self-driving cars. Will we be able to have programmed automobiles that, take us to work every day?
Cars that chauffeur you back and forth to work every day are not going to happen anytime soon because they're really hard to make. I mean, DARPA, which is the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, is going to sponsor in November. They're going to have a race out in, they had one, a successful race in the desert last year where cars actually managed to go, self-driving cars, from one point to another and actually finish. But next year, they're going to do one in an urban environment, which means cars then have to figure out about stoplights, about other cars, about stop signs, about yield, about all of the other things that happen if you're driving in a city. And people expect that race to be pretty entertaining in terms of what won't happen.
Right. Well, something a little more than half of your fellows say is likely to happen is that we'll discover Earth-like planets in the future. And some of them believe these planets will have living organisms on them. Nearly three-quarters of them said that if aliens are trying to communicate with us, we won't be able to understand what they're saying. And that reminded us that you also asked your experts if there will ever be a universal language translator where we might understand everyone's language here on Earth.
I think that from what we saw, the fellows thought that a universal language translator would be possible in the next 20 to 30 years. That's one of the holy grails. It's like speech recognition and handwriting recognition and a universal translator. These are things that people who've worked on this stuff for decades have been, and they think there may be some breakthroughs that are actually very close, where you can do speech recognition with 99% accuracy or handwriting recognition with 99% accuracy without having to train a device to do this with just sight unseen. The same with language translation. I mean, if you ever try to use Google to translate a page from Japanese, it comes out and it's sort of more like avant-garde poetry than it is some kind of language you would recognize. So if you can, I think to talk about extraterrestrials, I think if you can imagine that we can't even understand each other's languages, the idea that you might be able to understand signals that are coming from far away in the solar system, you can see why that would be a problem.
Right. Well, another area your survey explored is the field of nanotechnology, the creation of things on a tiny, tiny scale. It's been hyped as the next big thing, especially when it comes to medical procedures. Now, we know the 1960s movie Fantastic Voyage, but instead of teeny, tiny people in your bloodstream, for instance, this would be robotic versions of that. So what is the future of this, of these teeny, tiny machines?
The fantasy is that you would have these little nanorobots that could do surgery, so that instead of having some kind of invasive open-heart surgery, you might inject a set of nanorobots that would go in and make the repairs. There have been other sort of fantasy ideas about using them to do. Recently, you know, there have been astronauts on the space on the space station for hours trying to repair things, and in the future, one could imagine that such devices could be used to those purposes. But right now, people don't see them. It's going to take a long time for those things to happen.
Half of the respondents to your survey predict that most people in developed countries will have a documented personal genetic profile within 2 decades, and that's going to allow doctors to individualize medical therapies. Now, already today, we can, you know, weed out genetic defects if one wants to ensure that your offspring don't inherit them. We can choose the sex of offspring, color of eyes, if one wants. But this is a tricky field because it's where science meets morality for many, where biology meets engineering. So what are some of the things that people are telling you is going to be in the future?
Well, I think that we're right at the beginning of this revolution, and people think that a lot of the things with biology will happen long before some of the other more kind of engineering things. Some people call it hacking our biology. You know, we do it in very primitive ways now. I mean, Barry Bonds took steroids. People take Prozac. People do things to alter their personal biology. But it's all done in a very green thumb sort of way. So if you could imagine actually being able to engineer things into yourself, you know, could you augment your intelligence? Could you augment your athletic ability? Could you extend your lifespan? And so those would be the good things. The unintended consequences you could imagine would be creating life forms that you didn't mean to make, or making changes to human beings that actually change the course of human evolution in bad ways.
And given that, Susan Hassler, again, editor of IEEE Spectrum magazine, they spoke to engineers and scientists to peer into the future through their eyes. And when you talked to them, did any of them worry that, you know, it is going too far, that there's going to be almost a Luddite-like backlash that'll sort of send this, you know, what's been sort of a fast-forward advances in technology backwards for a little bit?
Oh, I think always with any technology that's going forward very quickly that you can have, you know, stops and starts. I mean, you know, the car wasn't accepted in this country for decades. until it was useful in San Francisco after the earthquake, because you couldn't get horses around and you could use cars to go around if you remember your Seabiscuit story. There are lots of ways in which technologies get stopped by people who suddenly get frightened. And I don't think we know exactly why, how all of this stuff will develop, which is why it's very important, not just for engineers and scientists to be talking about this, but for people to be talking about it. Mm. Because, I mean, as you mentioned at the top, if you think about how much our lives have changed even in the last 10 years, I mean, people didn't carry cell phones and IM each other and email each other and have this constant 24/7 connection to each other, you know, even just a decade ago. And we don't really understand yet how this social network that we're building is going to really affect the way that we live.
Susan Hassler is editor of IEEE Spectrum magazine. They asked their fellows to take a hard-nosed look at what technology is and isn't on the horizon. To see the entire Spectrum survey, go to our website, here-now.org. And Susan, thanks very much.
Thank you, Robin.
Okay, and still to come today, Congress considers the 9/11 recommendations. A 9/11 mother asks, why is it taking so long? You're listening to Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Today, more than 2 years after the 9/11 Commission issued its report on how to prevent terrorist attacks, Congress is taking action on the bulk of the recommendations from the Commission. The Senate is holding hearings, and the House is expected to pass Bill H.R. 1, enacting most of the Commission's recommendations. We'll speak with a mother who lost a son in the 9/11 attacks and testified in the Senate in a moment. But first, we go to Brian Bender of the Boston Globe. Brian, before today, Congress had enacted less than half of the 41 recommendations from the 9/11 Commission. So what does today's House bill call for?
Well, today's House bill is intended to basically plug what the Democrats think are holes remaining in Homeland Security. The way they want to do that is to adopt some of these recommendations from the 9/11 Commission that have kind of fallen by the wayside, checking all cargo that comes into America's ports, increasing nuclear security to prevent nuclear terrorism, a whole variety of things the Democrats are calling for, and it's going to be interesting to see whether the money will be there to actually do it and whether or not the experts think it's actually the right thing to do.
Well, one of the big concerns is the cost. In an editorial today, the Washington Post criticized an aspect of the bill that calls for every maritime cargo container bound for the U.S. to be scanned before it departs for the U.S. That's the cargo inspection you talked about. You know, the Post saying this could cost hundreds of billions of dollars.
It's expensive because it takes manpower, it takes new electronic scanning equipment, and, you know, literally millions and millions of cargo containers come into the United States every year. The criticism on the part of some is that while port security is a big concern, this is an example, or could be an example, of so-called feel-good security. We're checking everything, so therefore we're safe. And a lot of the intelligence experts will say that terrorists, Al-Qaeda, will simply look at the areas that are not being protected and focus their attention on those. Mm. So basically the argument is you can't protect everything. To open up every container or scan every container is going to bankrupt the country and in the end maybe not make us all that more secure.
Well, what were some of the other recommendations that will be taken up in the bill?
Well, one of the main recommendations is to change the formula for how Homeland Security funding is spread to localities. Currently, there's this formula where states are guaranteed a certain amount of federal money to buy communications equipment, to do other things to prepare for a possible disaster. The bill would change that so that the money would have to be released simply by risk. So the Homeland Security Department would have to determine which cities are most likely to be attacked.
There's been a lot of debate about that over the past couple of years as we've seen reports of small towns, you know, with a huge amount of money to arm the local police force, for instance. But there's also concern that some legislatures don't want to let go of the money that's coming to their cities. Will this recommendation get politicized?
I think certainly there could be a fight between some of these states that have gotten quite a bit of money and some of these big state legislators, like from New York. But I think there's general consensus that a risk-based approach is probably better than the system that has been in place. And the Bush administration has acknowledged that it needs to do better in parsing out some of this federal money.
One recommendation that wasn't included in the House bill was to allow Transportation Security Administration screeners to unionize and to provide them with whistleblower protections. What was the holdup with that recommendation being included in the House bill?
The government at times is a little wary about unionizing employees like that because they feel that that could impede the government's work in the future. If they want to move employees around, for example, to different positions, you might run into problems with the union. So it's a thicket that at this point the House Democrats decided they don't want to deal with. But down the road, I'm sure it's going to come up again.
Well, another recommendation from the 9/11 Commission, Brian, was to centralize congressional oversight of Homeland Security. Right now, there are several committees. The suggestion was that there be one, and it may be made up of both House and Senate members. What about that idea of centralizing it so that there's one committee with oversight of Homeland Security?
Well, that's been a major recommendation of the 9/11 Commission that has fallen by the wayside. The 9/11 Commission basically concluded that congressional oversight of Homeland Security was effectively bankrupt. You know, I think that's an issue, though, that will be debated because if they create one Homeland Security Committee, that means other committees will have to give up jurisdiction, which, as we all know, is not something Congress likes to do. But clearly, I think there's a consensus that the oversight of Homeland Security has not been very effective, and one of the reasons why is that there's just too many cooks in the kitchen.
Brian Bender of the Boston Globe speaking about today's action in Congress to implement more recommendations of the 9/11 Commission. Brian, thanks so much.
Sure.
Well, as we mentioned, the Senate's Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee held a full committee hearing today on the implementation of the 9/11 recommendations. Mary Fetchett was there. She lost her 24-year-old son Brad in the 9/11 attacks, and she's credited with leading the effort to form the 9/11 Commission as founder of Voices of September 11th. She testified today. We spoke to her earlier and asked what message she wanted to bring to the Senate.
The most important point that we want to make is our country is not safe today, and it's not safe to fly. It's not safe to take mass transit, and firefighters and first responders still can't communicate. My son worked on the 89th floor of Tower 2, and of course was told to remain in the building that day. 618 people perished in that building, and one of the key reasons that they perished is that the first responders couldn't communicate. We haven't come far enough.
Why do you think that is?
I think that there continue to be turf battles and people, are reluctant to make changes. I think complacency has set in on a lot of levels, and there's this mentality that if we kill the terrorists in other countries, they're not going to be here in the United States. But the fact is, were here in the United States, and we still today don't know who's traveling and living in this country because we don't have even a comprehensive watch list today.
I can't imagine that someone like you who's lost someone in 9/11 will ever be complacent. I mean, are you saying that there's a disconnect there?
I think there is a disconnect, and I can't afford to be complacent. You know, on 9/11, I didn't know that my son's life was at risk. I didn't know the Twin Towers was a target. I know today that my children's lives are at risk. And so knowing what I know, I feel really a moral obligation to make sure that the government is doing what it needs to do to make the country safer.
Do you have some confidence that the new Congress will push through some of these recommendations sooner? Or, you know, some critics are saying they're pushing them through too quickly and not giving them enough consideration. I mean, what's your faith?
Oh, yeah. God. Yeah. You know, how long is the debate going to be go on? I think there are some real leaders, and, you know, we're very optimistic about the legislation that's going through the House today. You know, what is going to happen if we have a nuclear attack and millions of people are affected, and we don't have these reforms implemented in their totality? I just wonder what is the excuse going to be.
Mary, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Mary Fetchett, founder of Voices of September 11th. She testified today in the U.S. Senate on implementing the recommendations of the 9/11 Commission. Her son, Brad, died in the attacks on the World Trade Center. Well, still to come today, the after-work life of carpenters. Pints on the Bar, and Verse on Bar Napkins, Carpenter Poetry. That's still ahead. You're listening to Here and Now. It seems every day brings another nutrition study. Well, now there's another one. It's a study of studies, and it claims that studies funded by the same industry they're reporting to research are 4 to 8 times more likely to yield positive results. Well, here now is Alan Cockle joins us in the studio. And Alan, this sounds familiar. You know, these are nutrition studies, but we're thinking about the drug studies, which seem to do the same thing.
Right. So it's pretty well accepted that pharmaceutical industry funding is a possible source of bias in medical research. So now the researchers have gone through, looked at the same thing for nutrition studies and found, lo and behold, that, yes, industry funding seems to have an overall effect of pushing the findings in favor of industry.
Well, these were researchers at Children's Hospital here in Boston. They reviewed more than 100 studies about soft drinks, juices, and milk. One group of researchers looked at the conclusions of the studies. One looked at who paid for the studies. And what'd they find?
They found overwhelmingly the studies went in favor of the industry group funding. For example, of the 78 studies that were actual clinical trials, intervention where they gave the juice or the milk and studied the health effects, not one went against industry. David Ludwig, the senior researcher on this project, says that has potential public health implications.
If a third or a half of the published studies have subtle but demonstrable bias affecting their conclusions, then it could shift the formulation of policy exclusively in one direction, favoring the interests of the food industry, without that becoming particularly apparent to either the people who are formulating the policy or to the general public.
Well, but Alan Cockle, you also spoke to the American Beverage Association. They take exception, don't they?
I did. This is a group that represents American soft drink makers and makers of other non-alcoholic beverages. They fund some research. They also lobby. Susan Neely, their president, said that, no, they fund this research, but they don't have anything to do with the conclusions.
We require that the funding source be disclosed. We require that it be published in a peer-reviewed publication. We have no input into the design, the statistical analysis, the analysis of the results or the conclusions. So we have very established criteria to ensure that the outcome is not affected by any input that would direct the results in an inappropriate way.
Well, what do Children's Hospital research think is going on here, Alan? Because I'm sure some of our listeners are saying, no way. If something's funded by the industry, of course it's going to be positive. But these are also serious, respected researchers. So what was the finding? Is it deliberate?
Well, I think it's, first of all, the study doesn't address that directly. They didn't look at individual studies, and they don't comment on the validity of any individual study. But it's been looked at more in the pharmaceutical situation, and, you know, there are several things that could be going on. One, industry only funds studies that they kind of know in advance are likely to go their way. The other thing that's a little more insidious is if you're funding, maybe you're a little less likely to, you know, go in a place where you know your funder doesn't want you to go. For the most part, no one is suggesting that there's overt bias on the part of academic researchers.
Well, and what's the finding as to why companies do this research?
Well, they undoubtedly do it because it's part of their marketing. For example, the dairy industry, which does this research, it's funded by a levy that's created by Congress on all the milk that's sold. They go back to 1929. Their first publication, in fact, of the National Dairy Council was Butter, a Protective Food. And they say, you know, right on their website and right in the name of the organization that part of their mandate is to do research and to promote the dairy industry. So, yeah, that's why they do it.
It's part of the marketing of the product. Well, Alan Cockle, as you said, this was just a, you know, a study of studies, but is there any sense that something might come of it?
Well, it's one study. So the researchers suggest that if this is confirmed, if other people look at this and find the same pattern, then maybe scientists do need to do something, either rejecting industry funding, or perhaps the government needs to say, look, we can't let so much of the nutrition research be funded by industry. We need to step in and fund more on our own so that we have a good, honest answer about what's good for us and what's not.
We should say that the finding was that studies that were funded by industry tended to be positive towards the industry. Who funded the other studies that didn't tend to be as positive towards the industry?
a range of funders. You know, a big one would be federal funding, like funding from the National Institutes of Health or something like that.
Here now is Alan Cockle. For more on the research done at Children's Hospital here in Boston on studies of soft drinks, juices, and milk underwritten by industries, go to our website, here-now.org. Alan, thanks.
Thank you.
Stay with us. More ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Some tradesmen in Boston are taking a cue from Walt Whitman, Charles Bukowski, and the cowboy poets by writing about what they do. They are carpenter poets, crafting works such as Death-Defying Postures and Another Missed Miter, and sharing them at the local watering hole. Here now's Andrea Shea has their story.
A crew of men perch on scaffolding that hugs the exterior of an old house in Boston.
Get that nail gun!
Inside, Carl Weinhardt of Rocksteady Builders takes a break. He's been a carpenter for 33 years and, on and off, also a poet, dabbling mainly in jingles. Writing and building have a lot in common, says Weinhardt, who wears suspenders that look like big, bright yellow rulers.
Everything about carpentry is repetition and following steps. And words are like that. I mean, you build them one after the other, and it passes the time of day. Says Euripides to Euripidos, these saws is dull and my fingers is froze. Looks like we's could use a couple of teas, says Euripidos to Euripides. And so they stopped to warm their maws, make fast the files and sharpen their saws. Says Euripides to Euripidos, we need more boards to build these shelves. Says Euripidos to Euripides, those boards ain't gonna rip themselves.
These days, Weinhardt's writing more than he used to. The poem you just heard, The Pit Saw, is a response to a challenge by his boss, Mark Regoven. Almost 2 years ago, Regoven walked into the carpenter's hangout, a tavern named James Gate, and he threw down a gauntlet.
An architect had emailed me a poem by Mark Turpin, who's a carpentry poet, and he's written a couple of books and everything. And Thursday nights, the carpenters in the area come in and have some pops after work. And I brought it in for, like, show and tell, and we all read the poem. And I said, we could do this. And everybody's pretty wordy, and I figured they'd take to that very well, putting words on paper. So, yeah, it was fun. It was like a little jam session.
The little jam session got big fast. Now the 20 or so carpenter poets organize well-attended readings at the bar twice a year with spontaneous gatherings in between.
Well, thank you once again for showing up for the Carpenter Poetry Participation Group. Hopefully everyone is going to be eager to read their own carpentry poem.
Hi, my name is Fran Regan. Titled it Carpenter's Confession. Show me the craftsman, and I will show you 100 more who, like myself, fell into the trade by default. Men and women who embarked.
The styles of poetry here run the gamut, so do the degrees of technicality and seriousness, but all of the poems are about carpentry. That's rule number one. Siobhan Murphy has a thing for limericks and says she was an apprentice when she rose to the challenge.
I put it off and put it off and put it off, and finally, I think I wrote it on a bar napkin.
For this night's event, though, Murphy wrote her untitled poem in advance.
If I had to name it, I guess I would name it Difficult Angle.
And what's it about?
Angle insecurity.
Angle envy?
Angle envy, yeah. This carpenter is working a hard angle, and it's got my panties all in a tangle. I'm thinking if I could just wrangle my tongue from its constant dangle, I'd figure out how I might not mangle this, a most difficult angle. I'll use one of many a tool and try my damnedest not to look like a fool. But at the base of my stool, the drool is beginning to form a pool. But this carpenter knows how to keep her cool. Just remember the bevel rule, and you'll cut it like a jewel.
Bar napkins are popular media for carpenter poems, but Joe Bergen says he prefers the material of his trade.
I always write them down on a piece of 2x4 and save them for later.
Bergen is a driving force behind the carpenter poets. He's written many poems over the years. A few, he says, are about his work.
To me, it was very satisfying writing about what you do every day. I think the cowboy poets do the same, and we feel very akin to them. They're sort of our brothers and sisters in that kind of literary endeavor.
Well, it's not surprising. We're talking about people who have the same profession and who gather together like cowboy poets do, and perhaps they'll be published one day in an anthology.
William Corbett is a poet and publisher who teaches writing at MIT. Corbett says the cowboy and carpenter poets are unique today because so many poets are teachers, and usually they aren't writing about their jobs. But even so, does Corbett think an anthology of carpenter poetry is publishable?
Absolutely. Now, what kind of reception it will have, I don't know. They've started to publish already. They're publishing as soon as they open their mouths in front of a group of people that includes more than just themselves.
Hello?
Hello?
I'm Liz Keith. Okay, this is called What Wood Teaches. I am wood, and I love when I am at the artisan's nimble fingers, humble task. In your safe arms before I am made for their extravagant needs. Spinning
talk
lights
of materials and tools saturate the poems, also customer relations, camaraderie, and big paydays. Structural memory is at the heart of Bill Thibodeau's piece titled Too Slow for Demolition. Thibodeau is one of the two published poets in the group.
It's the movement of time, the skill of past carpenters, and the stories and voices that flow through a stream of generations, when heard by the pure of heart, voices that thunder like Brahman, within and without these plastered walls and ceilings, that light my eyes and guide my hands. No, I don't make a very good demo, man. I'm just too slow. I owe them that much.
There's little stories in all these houses, and the people who build those houses, are they still alive? Are they dead? You know, they meant something at one time. They just don't disappear in the works there. So the poem about me taking things down, I just didn't want to go in there with a bulldozer and knock it down. I thought that I owe them some honor, in a sense, just to go in there with a little respect.
The carpenter poets clearly respect their trade, their poems, and each other. But Joe Bergen says rule number 2 stipulates no judging.
Some heckling is certainly encouraged, but no critiquing.
This is J.D. Bergen's work. It's one of my favorite poems I've ever heard. I broke the rule. I did a job I could see from my house. Twice. One nearly drove me to madness and bankruptcy. The other one turned out nice.
Fun, affection, and a common cause feed this phenomenon. Gauntlet thrower Mark Regoven says he'd like to see the poetry bug spread throughout his industry.
I would actually like this to be from the perspective of, for instance, a building inspector, a plumber, a homeowner. I would like every aspect of the whole process to weigh in on with a poem.
And who knows, maybe some inspectors, homeowners, and even painters out there might be willing to rise to Regoven's latest challenge. Here and Now's Andrea Shea. For more on the Carpenter Poets, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.